Hello and welcome to The World in 30 Minutes, the podcast on the events, policies and ideas that will shape the world from the European Council on Foreign Relations. My name is Mark Leonard. I'm Director of ECFR. And this week's podcast is about international law and justice. Both the war in Gaza and the war in Ukraine are deeply rooted in claims about international law, whether it's the validity of different territorial claims, the question of when the use of force is permitted, the role of the International Court of Justice and the ICC in prosecuting wrongdoers. And since February 2022 and the 7th of October 2023, tragically, there have also been a whole series of questions around international humanitarian law. Who and what can be considered a legitimate target? What distinguishes a combatant from a non-combatant? And what can be considered an act of proportional retaliation? Most controversially is the question of genocide. What constitutes genocide? Is genocide being committed in either of these conflicts? And who and how should it be decided? Unusually, these complicated questions have filtered through to the news and through social media into everyday discourse, and they have been important questions being argued out in all sorts of different fora about the role of international law and international justice in today's increasingly fragmented world. There are questions about whether we live in an age of impunity, what international law can achieve, what it can't achieve. Do accusations of Western double standards have merit? And is there a constructive role for international law to play when it comes to achieving justice in either Ukraine, Gaza, or many other places around the world? To help us make sense of these questions, and many more probably, we have Anthony Dworkin, who's a senior policy fellow at ECFR. He has worked for a very long time on questions to do with human rights, democracy and justice, and in a past life even set up and led an NGO looking at crimes of war and laws of war. What was it called, your NGO?
It was called the Crimes of War Project.
And I don't think that we've ever been in a period where these topics have been more relevant to the overall discourse. And the tensions between how people are framing these things from one theatre to another have become a central part of international politics. Anthony, welcome to podcasts. Why don't we start with the very big picture? You know, what can you maybe talk a bit more about how you see this role of international law being played and has been framed in the two conflicts?
Thanks, Mark. And it's good to be on the podcast. So as you rightly say, I mean, I think it's really striking if you look at the both Russia's war in Ukraine and the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza, you know, how much the discussion about these conflicts is framed in terms of international law. And I think that's partly because there are some, you know, very big legal questions, as you rightly mentioned in your intro, that are at stake here. It's also, I think, because international law frames the way we understand the claims that the sides are making, how it shapes our understanding of how war should be fought. You know, there are these questions about occupation, about self-defense, a lot of ideas which are rooted in international law. And I think that frames the way that we look at these questions. And then beyond that, there's just the practical matter that in both these conflicts, there are a lot of international courts that have a role. So the International Court of Justice has been looking at both the question of genocide in relation to Russia's war on Ukraine, where Ukraine brought a case against Russia claiming that Russia was wrongly invoking genocide as a pretext for its attack. And also, as is, you know, widely known, in relation to Israel and Gaza. In addition, there's another case before the International Court of Justice that's looking at the wider legal context surrounding Israel's long-term occupation of Palestinian territory. And then it happens that the International Criminal Court, which is the body that pursues criminal cases against individuals for violations of core international laws, the laws of war, crimes against humanity, and indeed genocide, that also has jurisdiction in both these contexts, because Ukraine has accepted the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, and Palestine is a party to the ICC. So you also have that kind of criminal investigation or examination, at least, going on alongside it. So, you know, there are kind of a lot of legal cases as well as a lot of legal reference points. And I think when we think about what is permissible in these conflicts, what's the rightness of the or the wrongness of the justification for the use of force by each side, is how far does, for instance, Israel have a right of self-defense? How far does that extend? What are the obligations that they should be meeting? We've heard Europeans say again and again that Israel has a right to defend itself in line with international law and in line with international humanitarian law. So by invoking those parameters, again, it sets up the question of how far they're doing that. So, you know, I think in all of these ways, international law is really setting the framework for understanding the kind of rights and wrongs of what each side should be doing and is doing.
So, you know, it's a lot. We've only got 30 minutes, so we should sort of decide a bit about how to do it. But there are, so I think it would be interesting to look at some of these specific elements that you've been describing, like self-defense, I think, is a very important one. Genocide is another very important one. And then, you know, the difference between civilians and non-civilians and who you can attack. I think those are at least three kind of really big things that we should talk about. But before we do that, maybe a little sort of meta question, because you said that international law is providing a framework. Is it a framework, or is this just yet another charge sheet that gets thrown around when you talk about, you know, nowadays, the first thing people seem to do as soon as there is a conflict between two countries is to evoke genocides, international law, crimes against humanity. It's become a very debased currency. And, you know, where you started with the ICJ pushing back against the Russians' false use of genocide shows, you know, how much the currency's been debased by people invoking it whenever they disagree with each other. Is it really a kind of useful framework, or is it just another kind of way of insulting one another?
Well, there's a long history of both sides in conflicts going well back before the conflicts we see today, accusing each other of war crimes. And I think that the fact that these allegations are made in a way testifies to the kind of continuing emotional power and the kind of normative force that's associated with charges of war crimes. You know, I think there is quite a widespread sense that whatever the rights and wrongs of resorting to force in a particular context, that there are limits that make sense to people about how you should fight. And so, you know, yes, these accusations get thrown around a lot because countries that are involved in a war want to use every tool at their disposal to try and strengthen their case and strengthen what seems like the justice and rightness of their cause and undermine their opponents. But I think, you know, because the terms are being used and misused doesn't mean that they've become meaningless. You know, perhaps it means that there's a greater burden on those of us who are looking at the conflict to try and sort the claims, you know, assess them on their merits, try to restore or as much as possible preserve the kind of, you know, the force of the words and the terms that are being used. And, You know, I think this is for Europeans, this is a particularly significant thing. Europeans have long been committed to upholding the international rule of law. You know, the courts that we're talking about are located in Europe. And so I think it's important to try and make sure that the terms retain their meaning.
So it's quite difficult to disaggregate the use of those terms from this sort of idea of double standards and this idea of different, which I suppose it was another way of framing why I asked you in the first question. But maybe we should take some of these claims one at a time and think about what they mean in the different conflicts. So self-defense is something which, it is an absolutely fundamental right, which is enshrined in international law and which everyone understands. But what's murkier is what it means and how far you can use it as a justification for a war and against what kinds of people. Can you explain a bit more some of the topics, can you unpack it a bit, the debates that we're having now about self-defense?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think just on the double standards point that you mentioned, you know, I think that is, it's a real issue. You know, maybe we'll come back to that in a bit, because I think there are, you know, that's, as I was saying about the importance of using the terms accurately to preserve their credibility, I think part of the credibility is also some sense that when you're criticizing countries for violating these laws, that you're doing it in a way that has behind it a consistent sense of the law's importance. So, you know, to sort of go all in criticizing Russia for its violations of the laws of war, but appear to overlook violations when they're committed by other countries, as may have been the case, at least I think for the initial phases of the conflict in relation to Israel, it is problematic. We can come back to that. But in terms of self-defense, you know, this is shaping the overall kind of scope of the conflict. So if a country is facing an armed attack from another country or, from a non-state actor as well, then it's well understood that they have the right to respond. And generally, you know, it's kind of framed as the right to take all measures that are necessary to push back the attack and to remove the threat that the attacker poses. But this has to be done only as far as the actions taken are necessary and proportionate. You know, are they actually contributing to pushing back the attack? And is the kind of scale and scope of the action appropriate in relation to the threat that the country is facing? So with Russia and Ukraine, you know, we see a very clear case where Russia has kind of massively invaded Ukrainian territory and Ukraine is simply trying to push the Russians back and push them out. You can imagine a situation if Ukraine was successful where a question could arise about does the right of self-defense allow them to carry on into Russia. That situation seems a long way away. And I think the priority now is just trying to get the best resolution and the best outcome that Ukraine can achieve in difficult circumstances. In the case of Israel and Hamas, you know, I've been kind of struck by a lack of real discussion about what the extent of self-defense is in this case. There's been a lot of discussion and analysis about how far Israel is or is not complying with the laws of war. And of course, it's, you know, Hamas also is taking actions, including holding on to the hostages that are violations of the laws of war. But how far does Israel's right to defend itself against Hamas go? You know, we've seen this massively destructive military campaign, which is aimed at completely eliminating Hamas, even if the cost seems to be destroying Gaza as a whole. And I think there's a real question about whether the right of self-defense extends beyond simply kind of reducing the military capabilities and capacity of Hamas to actually eliminate the organization as a whole. Now, that may not be possible, but that's the stated goal. And I think there is a real question about whether that is necessary or proportionate.
And if, so imagine we were able to do that and have that debate, you know, who would be the ones to decide? How would it be done? On what sort of time scale? Is this something for the historians, or is this something which can actually have a real world impact?
Well, those aspects of international law to do with the relations between states are typically questions for the International Court of Justice. But the International Court of Justice only has jurisdiction if the states involved accept that, with one or two exceptions. And that's why we see the Genocide Convention being used in this case, because states that sign up to the Genocide Convention accept the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. So there's no obvious way of kind of getting a decision from the International Court of Justice about self-defense in these cases, but there is a way of bringing in the Genocide Convention, which is why we see that these cases being sort of shoehorned into the context of the Genocide Convention. But it's not only a case, I think, of, you know, whether a court is ruling on these things, because, as I've said, the Europe and the US have both have said Israel has the right to defend itself in line with international law. So I think part of the debate that they should be having is how far that right extends and how far are they going to support Israel.
So you think the Attorney General in the US or in the UK or wherever or whoever the relevant legal authorities are in different European countries should decide whether self-defense is being exceeded and whether the campaign is no longer in line with international law? How would one even know?
Well, it's a judgment call. And I think that it would be, I mean, we've seen statements, for instance, from the Irish government that they believe that the limits of self-defense are being exceeded. But I think, you know, more than just having a kind of a clear statement, I think this should be part of the discussion that's going on about the level of support and the kind of support and the kind of transition to an end to the campaign taking place between European countries and Israel, between the United States and Israel. There is, I think, it's easy to be kind of cynical about international law in contexts where there's no clear means of enforcing it. But I think these questions about the normative basis for the campaign, the rightness and the wrongness of it, are a key part of the kind of international politics surrounding the war. And, you know, these discussions, I think, take place perhaps behind closed doors. And I think there should be a little bit more focus on this question of how far the war should extend and what Israel's war goals are.
So maybe, I mean, you mentioned that genocide is something where there have actually been some court cases and obviously the South African accusation that Israel's committing genocide has taken up a lot of attention. But there are also these accusations of genocide, both from the Russians towards the Ukrainians as part of their casus belli, and then from the Ukrainians against the Russians in the light of a lot of the crimes of war, which seem to have been committed since the full-scale invasion in February of 2022. Do you want to talk a bit more about genocide is a crime with a particular resonance. Is in many ways the kind of most heinous crime against humanity that one can imagine. How would you say international law is being used around genocide? Is it something that's going to have a practical impact? What's your reading of the these different court cases that we've seen so far?
Well, genocide, it's like, as you say, genocide is like a very kind of specific crime. On the one hand, it's quite a precise and narrowly defined crime. And on the other hand, it has this standing as the kind of crime of crimes, you know, the kind of most serious violation of international law, which I think means that countries that feel that they're the victims of like a really serious campaign of atrocities, you know, there is kind of a always, I think, an instinct to reach for the charge of genocide to register the scale of what they feel the atrocities involved are. And also, as I was saying, in both these cases, there also is the fact that genocide may be one of the only ways of getting the conflict before the International Court of Justice. But essentially, for something to qualify as genocide, it has to be an attempt to destroy, in whole or in part, a particular ethnic, national, racial, or religious group. And you have to prove not only that the campaign is tending towards that goal, but that that's the intention of what's being done. And so in the case of Russia and Ukraine, it seems that the International Court of Justice is not going to, it doesn't see the question of whether Russia is wrongly invoking genocide as sufficient grounds to get involved, at least in assessing the justice of Russia's military campaign. But in the case of Israel and Hamas, then what the court found in this case, essentially, where South Africa appealed for these provisional measures, in other words, a kind of initial steps that the court might rule just to prevent further harm while the case was being heard on the merits, the threshold to meet those is comparatively low. And the court found that there was a plausible case that Israel was responsible for violations of the Genocide Convention, which I think is, on the face of it, significant. It's definitely a kind of powerful finding. It'll be a greater challenge for Israel, for South Africa to win the case on the merits, where the threshold is much higher and they'd have to really show a kind of clear intent. But in the meantime, the provisional measures that the court ordered, some of them I think are significant and important, particularly the one to allow greater humanitarian aid. And what we've seen now is South Africa going back to the court, asking for further provisional measures, because they're saying that then in light of the deteriorating humanitarian situation, there needs to be stronger steps to ensure that the aid is getting through. So I think what we see is that even while a final ruling is a long way off, the court is being used in a way that I think is kind of helpful and constructive to focus international attention and to try and hold Israel a little bit to account on this humanitarian question, which is one that many people around the world, I think, are increasingly looking at.
And in terms of holding Israel to account, obviously it's up to Israel whether it cares about what the ICJ says. It's not entirely clear that it cares that much. Is it mainly because you think this might have an impact on some of Israel's supporters that it matters? Or because presumably, no Israelis are going to end up in prison or as a result of it. Or it's not like the ICC where you are going to indict leaders of countries for particular things.
Yeah, the ICJ is not going to prevent Israeli officials from traveling overseas for fear of arrest. And it's true that ultimately whatever measures they impose, can only be enforced through the Security Council or whatever. And I think, Israel cares enough about its reputation and its standing that it has contested the case. It's made its submissions, it argued against it, and it's continuing to engage. But yes, I think that's true. The primary method is going to be through Israel's supporters. And I think for a variety of reasons, partly, of course, just the way the campaign is being conducted, but also I think the legal scrutiny that it's receiving, we've seen a shift away. So a number of European countries have suspended weapons supplies. In one case, I think in Belgium, they specifically referenced the ICJ hearing. And in the United States, there's increasing debate about whether the blockade, blocking of humanitarian aid, including restrictions on U.S. humanitarian aid, means that the U.S. should be taking kind of measures in terms of suspending military assistance and so on. So again, these may not immediately result in weapons supplies to Israel being cut off, but I think it's part of the overall picture of increasing pressure coming through Israel's allies and on those allies through domestic political debate to try and get Israel to do more on humanitarian questions, to get it to suspend or hold off from military operations like in Rafah that would clearly have a massive civilian toll. Yes, we shouldn't overestimate what legal action on its own can do, but I think we shouldn't also underestimate the importance of having these kinds of normative frameworks as a basis for judging what the actions of countries are doing in both of these conflicts.
So I think we should spend the rest of our time talking about double standards, probably, because that's something which has been sort of evoked and which is in the background on all of these things. I mean, to what extent do you think that European countries have been guilty of double standards in terms of how they are looking at Russian war crimes, where they've been very vocal and specific about the different ways in which Russia has broken international law, and very vocal about the need to stop, and their attitudes towards sort of accusations of breaches of international law in Israel. I mean, are these really similar enough for those actually to be double standards, or is it just the fact that these are very two different kind of crises? One where you have the clear case of self-defense in the wake of a horrendous massacre, and the other which looks like an unprovoked invasion of a sovereign country. I mean, to what extent is this about double standards, or is it just that they're very different sets of situations?
It could be both, and I think it is both. And yes, the situations are different. And of course, the way that countries talk about international law and talk about justice processes is going to be somewhat context dependent. For instance, you might feel that having a justice process or having a criminal, international tribunal involved in one conflict is going to be helpful. You might feel that having it involved in another conflict could be counterproductive. But nevertheless, I think when you are talking about the whether countries are observing or not observing the laws of war, there's a certain obligation to have a kind of consistency in how you apply the standards. So some crimes are very clear cut. The evidence that we saw coming out of Bucha about people who'd been bound and clearly executed is an indisputable war crime. In the case of some of what Israel was doing, it was initially perhaps more to do with the conduct of hostilities. And those are questions that involve the proportionality of the attacks. Are they directed at military targets? Are they causing civilian harm that's disproportionate to the value of those targets? You can see perhaps that those require some kind of greater knowledge of what's happening on the ground. Nevertheless, as time has gone on and the death toll has mounted, we see the kinds of weapons that Israel has been using, the kind of targets they've been striking, the failure to let in humanitarian aid. I think the evidence has just got stronger and stronger about Israel's failure to observe international humanitarian law and the evidence that Israel has committed war crimes. And I think it has reached a point where clearly European states are pretty uncomfortable, and some of them are getting much more vocal about the need for ceasefires. But I think there has been a difference in approach which is potentially going to undermine the credibility of European accusations. So it's part, I think it's really important if you're trying to maintain war crimes as a meaningful standard that it, you only that you don't only appear to call them out against countries that are strategic opponents, that you call them out when you see them across the board. Now, there also is this question about whether the involvement of the courts, including the genocide case before the ICJ, for instance, the UK said that it was not going to be helpful in the effort to achieve a sustainable settlement of the conflict. And I think, as I said, it's not necessarily double standards to say something is unhelpful in a particular context. But here, I think that I really disagree with what the UK is saying. To me, it seems more likely that having international law involved in the Israel-Hamas conflict and the broader context of Israel's relations with the Palestinians, it's more likely to be effective in terms of helping create the foundations for a sustainable peace than it is in the Russian context. And so I've been a little bit skeptical about the case for setting up a tribunal to prosecute Putin for aggression, where it seems to me uncertain what that's going to achieve. But for the reasons that we've been talking about, basically, I think to do with the degree to which countries that are committed to the rule of law are Israel's most prominent supporters, I think having Israel in a position where it's being held to account for its actions, having certain kinds of standards imposed, making clear that the settlements are a violation of international law, having a situation where the ongoing occupation and the denial of self-determination is seen to be internationally rejected and again, a violation of international law. All of this seems to me can only help ultimately to push the situation towards circumstances where we're more likely to get a sustainable and just outcome. So in that sense, I think where some of the rhetoric that the Europeans and the Americans are using is just wrong.
And what's your answer? I can't remember when it was. I think actually probably 15, maybe even 20 years ago that I came across this word, which has become much more fashionable now, of lawfare. But I think it was on a visit to Israel where a lot of people were talking about how asymmetric the use of international law is and how, you know, in many ways, democracies are sort of tying themselves in knots because there are lots of vexatious uses of international law against democracies by actors who are, you know, supremely uninterested in any kind of law, whether it's domestic or international, in terms of their own affairs. But they game the system and they try and use. And Israel is obviously, as a democracy, surrounded by much less democratic countries, is very aware, is acutely aware of how international law is being used against it. And there's definitely been a huge tendency of people to try and use international law to push back against Israel, you know, whether it's at a kind of global level or whether it's you know, within national context, when it comes to different measures being taken to, you know, either support a two-state solution, sort of differentiating between occupied and non-occupied territories, but anyway, the whole gamut of different uses. Is that something that you worry about? That this is something which is so asymmetrical that actually could end up having unintended consequences in terms of the pursuit of justice?
Well, again, it's a natural instinct, I think, of countries to claim that when they or their supporters are invoking international law, it's being done for nothing but the best reasons. And when their opponents are invoking international law, it's because they're gaming the system and trying to instrumentalize law. And it's natural that both sides will try and use law to their advantage. I mean, in the case of Israel and the Palestinians, I think the power asymmetry is with Israel. And to my mind, anything that tries to restrain Israel's actions and make them conform to its international legal obligations is going to be helpful in terms of not only preventing violations of international law, not only preventing in the context of this campaign extreme suffering to the victims of its armed attacks, but I think also ultimately is going to be the best foundation for trying to find a kind of constructive and durable settlement to this extremely long-running situation of injustice, occupation, and the best foundation for security for both Israel and Palestine. So, you know, I think the kind of lawfare phrase was, it was invoked a lot in the context of asymmetric conflicts, not only Israel, but also the U.S. when it was in the post 9/11 period fighting counterinsurgency. And there was this trend to think that countries were, that there was too much emphasis on the obligations of attackers to prevent harm to civilians. But I think if we look back over the period of U.S. military campaigns during this period, I think that the evidence is that these campaigns have turned out to be very costly in terms of human life. And I don't see evidence that they were kind of excessively restrained by legal burdens. So to my mind, the law is playing a constructive role.
Okay, but I think we're already over time, but maybe I can let you have one last sort of answer, which is, you know, we've had a really long, quite interesting canter around the different parts of international law in these different conflicts. But what's the conclusion that viewers, that listeners should take from this discussion about how European countries and citizens should think about international law in our geopolitical moment?
I think that they should look at international law as something that is helpful in a more fragmented, in a more competitive, in a more multipolar world. The ways of cooperating internationally are getting fewer. The kind of common points of agreement between countries are getting more limited. The multilateral mechanisms that we've relied on in the past are being eroded and are becoming competitive spaces. These are all things we've looked at a lot at ECFR. But I think to the degree that international law and the laws that apply in conflict, the foundation of international rule of law, really, in the UN Charter and the right of self-defense, to the extent that these things still have meaning and popular significance around the world, which I think they do, then Europe should do everything it can to try and uphold their credibility, to try and apply them consistently, and to really try and live out the belief that they contribute to a more stable and just world. And I think in both these conflicts, they should, the line that they've taken, I think, is right, that that there is a right of self-defense in line with international law and international humanitarian law. And I think they should just be making sure that when they say that, they're following through in terms of what that means.
What a lofty note on which to end this podcast. We got one thing left to do, which is our bookshelf segment. Anthony, what's on your bookshelf at the moment?
So I would recommend for anyone who is following all these issues, the many issues that we've touched on in this discussion, a really good source for following these things is a blog called Just Security, run by a group of law professors in the United States. They have really terrific coverage. They've written a lot on Gaza, Ukraine, and many other international legal questions. And the book that I'm reading I guess it goes to the question of double standards, at least. It's called Equality, the History of an Elusive Idea. And it's a kind of intellectual history of the way that different societies and cultures have looked at equality, and basically making the argument that your view of equality is defined by who is excluded. So inequality is always the shadow side of equality. It's by an American academic called Darren McMahon.
Fantastic. We'll put links up to all the publications we mentioned on our website at ecfr.eu. If you've enjoyed listening to this episode, please head to whatever platform you use to listen to the podcast and subscribe to future episodes. And while you're there, it would be fantastic if you could give us a positive review and a 5-star rating. But for now, from Anthony and myself, Mark Leonard, it's goodbye. The researcher for this podcast is Anand Sundar, and the editor of this episode is Mireya Farrow-Saratz.